Welcome to the 67th edition of the Gooner Podcast, recorded immediately after our previous one on the Monday after Arsenal's goalless home draw with Sunderland the night before we played Barcelona in the Camp Nou. Thanks as ever to our sponsors, GoonerShirts.com, the website for all your quality cult Arsenal t-shirt needs. I'm your host, David Udo, and we've had a quick game of musical chairs on the panel, as symbolically replacing original Gooner editor Mike Francis is the current incumbent, Kevin Witcher. The other seats remain filled by Joe Broadfoot and Gunner Talks, Lindsay Sheehan. More alcohol has been consumed since Podcast 66, but we're all mature enough to handle it. To say that again, we are all mature enough to handle it. Let's start by Lindsay, if you'd be so kind as to read out an email that was sent in after the podcast posted in early February.
Dear Sirs, the latest episode of the podcast, 65, was expletive deleted shit. Although you've never hit the heights of It's Up for Grabs Now, Tuesday Club, or the Arseblog Arsecast, I've always enjoyed listening to your balanced, informative, and occasionally very funny podcast. However, this latest episode was so dire that even though it's free, I felt I was ripped off. The host had absolutely no control over the other cretins, whom after a drink suddenly found themselves extremely funny and enjoyed the sound of their own voices far too much. Basti was particularly annoying, and if you would like to make some kind of atonement, I would suggest punching him in the teeth until he cried. Sort it out, otherwise I won't buy the expletive deleted fanzine ever again. Kind regards, Mark Bryars. P.S. Kevin Witcher is fantastic.
Kevin Witcher, your thoughts?
What a sensible listener.
How are you related to Mr. Bryars?
In fairness, I had listened to that podcast. There was some football content. However, it was unquestionably too long, 45 minutes, even though our host was under instructions to wrap it up at 30. I think we'll just have to file that under the one that got away. Apologise to those of you who weren't amused by it. I can assure you that those who took part in it did seem to be, but we are in possession of a more sensible panel this evening. I hope we are at least more relevant, if not as irreverent. And moving on swiftly, David, let's move on to football.
Rumours that Basti and the Highbury Spy have been given a free transfer to a Tottenham podcast are as yet unconfirmed. Sunday the 27th of February 2011 will go down in history for many reasons. For some, it will be Chris and Wes winning Got to Dance on Sky One. For me personally, it will be a stonking hangover and being given the elbow by my missus by BBM, by a BlackBerry message. Thanks, Nicola, if you're listening. For others, it will be a nice day out at Wembley. However, finishing with, bizarrely, in the last minute, Laurent Koscielny and Wojciech Szczesny engaging in a private game of leapfrog and 40,000 red and white hearts get broken. Let's take half an hour to reflect on the 2011 Carling Cup final. Lindsay, what did 27th of February hold for you?
A pile of shit, actually. It started very, very well. The sun was shining. We all were optimistic. Then the A1 and the A41 got shut. All the trains weren't running. Got to Wembley. Wembley is now grim and commercial. The heavens opened. And then that happened.
Joe, what were you up to on the 27th of February, aside from watching Arsenal capitulate in O2 familiar fashion?
I was getting ready to go to Japan, and I delayed my trip just so I could watch on television. And, obviously, I expected us to win, but I knew that Arsenal being Arsenal, there was always a chance that we might slip up. I did say to my friend who's a Birmingham City fan, I said, I can see this going to extra time, penalties. We might not win on penalties, but I certainly didn't think we were going to lose in that fashion. So to say I was upset is such an understatement. I think it's the most upset I've been since 1972 when we lost to Leeds, and that was a dot on the cards, quite honestly. This game, we didn't even play very well. So I couldn't say it was bad luck. And how Szczesny even stayed on the pitch after fouling whoever it was when he was breaking through on goal.
Championship footballer, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that token championship, and it's Lee Bowyer, I think. And that foul should have seen him get the red card. So I couldn't actually say we were being, we were cheated, we were unlucky. We weren't unlucky at all. And I thought, our luck's in. And that's why I got so upset. I think that's why, because because there was a couple of other incidents where I thought they're going to score and they didn't. Yeah, when we hit the post, we actually scored right after. So I thought, oh, it's our lucky day. Mm. We're gonna turn this around. Okay, we've gone a goal behind. We're going to win 2-1. And it didn't happen.
So Joe's delayed trip to Japan, Lindsay's heart being broken by transport for London, thanks Mr. Crow, and the weather. Kev, I know your little one had a game in the morning. Did he at least win that?
Strangely enough, he didn't.
Oh no!
For him, without getting too self-indulgent, it was after the Lord Mayor's show, because it was their final league match of the season. They'd won the title the week before, beating a much better team, and it was like when Arsenal played Birmingham in the 2004 Invincible season, having won the title at the Lane the previous weekend. It was the dullest game in the history of association football, 0-0, with I don't think one attempt on target. The players basically had done the job, and the one thing they managed to do was not get beaten, and hence established that incredible record. So it didn't matter too much because they'd won their pot. However, Arsenal were in need of the first one for a few years, and in theory it should not have been that difficult an ask, and really we've got to find out what went wrong and why it happened. But the bottom line to me is no Cesc Fabregas equals problems, because I mean, we will talk about the options there, but the lack of fluidity in the team on a surface which frankly is now a very good one. Wembley used to be a joke, however a new company came in to take care of the pitch about a year, 18 months ago.
Same company that does the Emirates pitch?
Since then it's been a very fine football pitch on which it should suit Arsenal to play their game, especially given that it had been raining. The ball was fast over the surface, you know, there was no impediment to playing the style of football that Arsenal are so good at in theory. But it didn't click on the day, and that is a big part of the reason that we did not bring home the pot.
Someone sent me a text message later that evening, which read, "Tomasz Rosicki, aside from being the best KD Lang lookalike I've ever seen, is ultimately very pretty but completely pointless. Yet, in a cup final, despite the fact that the guy has been completely and utterly ineffectual this season, his sole contribution to the side was the opening goal in the 1-1 draw at Leighton Orient. Gets picked to play in the playmaker role rather than Samir Nasri, who filled in for 2 months in the first half of the season when Fabregas was injured and, you know, won the Premier League Player of the Month 2 months in a row, rather than Jack Wilshere, whose selection as a holding midfield player for Arsenal and for England has been widely derided by the football-watching people. Not Andrei Arshavin, our mercurial Russian outside left who's been begging to play in a more central role. No, we instead go for Tomasz Rosicki, who was a hell of a player when on his cold medication." In the words of Noel Gallagher, Lindsay, where did it all go wrong?
Well, I think you've just put your finger on it there. It was the whole thing. Just, I've never seen the players come. That was a Wembley final. Barsri Sagna back was all over Twitter about he was bringing that trophy home. And yet when you watch them come out, they didn't. It looked like they were rabbits in headlights for the first bit of it. They looked like the occasion had got to a few of them. And then they gift-wrapped it away. I thought the second half we were going to come out and we were going to push now. But I have to say that I think, like Kevin, that the game was almost lost at Stoke, because when you're running up against a wall all the time, to have somebody that can just make those runs and get in behind, and without Cesc, I think that the game was almost lost the week before. I think also the injuries played in people's heads. The minute Van Persie went off, it looked like it had just collapsed, really. Arshavin, I thought, was a passenger for the second half as well. There was a lot of disappointing performances on that pitch, not necessarily just the two that got highlighted because of the calamity.
Is it a mental thing for you, Joe? Or was it just a question of the players not turning up? Yeah, what?
Well, I blamed Arsene Wenger for a lot of it, quite honestly. As you were pointing out earlier, the team selection from the start was decidedly dodgy, because playing Rosicki, everyone was saying, why is Rosicki playing that role? As you pointed out, David, Nasri plays that role very well, that kind of playmaker role. He would be a prime suspect to play there. Or Arshavin, who, as you rightly pointed out, has wanted to play there from the time he arrived, but tends to get put out on the wing, where he's a little bit less effective, or a lot less effective, yet he still set up the goal. And to me, when Arshavin went off, I wasn't sure if he was injured, and I was thinking, why is Wenger taking him off? Obviously, Van Persie had to go off because he'd taken quite a bad knock in scoring what was a spectacular goal. And I could understand why Rosicki was in the team, but not in that particular position. That, when you've got Nasri in the team, why do it? When you know Nasri can do it. Arsene Wenger knows, right? We're told this all the time. Surely he knows that.
I'll be honest with you, I had a bad feeling about the game from the very off. For a start, it's a cup final day and it's shooting down with rain. Has to be sunny on cup final day. I don't care if it's the League Cup final. I don't care if it's FA Cup final. That automatically put me on a bad foot. Also, on the Metropolitan line train from Moorgate, all the way up, it was a train filled with gooners, and all I could hear was people saying, where are you sitting? Oh, can you see where they pick the trophy up from there? You know, where are you going for a drink afterwards? You know, are they going to do a bus stop parade for this? And I was just thinking, hang on. We need to calm down here. And it was too inevitable for me. Kev, were you at all worried, or did you kind of think, in fairness, maybe it was a bit of a slam dunk, but, you know, where were you on it?
Basically, I never at any stage considered the game would be a gimme. I certainly thought that Birmingham would play out of their skins. I mean, there is nothing like a cup final to give a team that rarely get a sight of silverware. I mean, you know, two things can happen. They can just completely freeze. I mean, that does happen to some teams who don't make cup finals. But on the other side of the coin, you sometimes get incredible performances. I mean, you know, going back in time, Coventry beating Spurs in 1987, and that kind of thing. Mm. I won't talk about teams beating Arsenal in cup finals before the Birmingham one, but it's happened. I mean, we had to win that game with more than a superior team sheet. It's interesting that it's almost felt like a game at home when you get a team that's a relegation contender coming to visit, and Arsenal just coming up against the wall, and yet the wall was even tougher because the incentive was so much greater for the visiting team, or in this case, you know, Birmingham mm. and on neutral soil. It just basically, we did create opportunities. We were good enough to actually create chances, but ultimately we rarely bossed the game. I think we had about 15 to 20 minutes in the second half when we looked in control. It felt like it should be. Arsenal were running the show. You thought, well, we've got this here. You know, we can actually win this. But because the goal didn't come, it just got closer to the end, and we're thinking about extra time. We're thinking, well, maybe we can do them because we're fitter. And then you cannot legislate for the kind of error that led to the goal. It was a freak goal, but by not killing off the game, we left ourselves in the position where, you know, you are going to suffer if a mistake is made. I just think it was a bad day at the office, and the team selection could have made a difference. I mean, Rosicki should not have started. The guy hasn't played well for a long, long time. Bentner has done okay wide, and Wenger has certainly picked him to play there a number of times. So why didn't he play him there and stick Nasri in the more creative position? It does come down to another Arsenal mistake. It's the same as he made in 2008 in the semi-final. 2009 was it, when Arshavin and Song didn't start.
Yeah, 2009 against Chelsea.
Semi-final against Chelsea. Selection. So basically the manager's to blame at the end of the day. He picked the wrong team and we got the just desserts, and fair play to Birmingham. They played to the absolute limit of their capabilities and it was enough. Granted, it took a mistake from us, but as has been pointed out, we got lucky in after 2 minutes anyway. We should have been down to 10 men. So I've no complaints at all about the result, but it's just an opportunity lost, and it's one of many. You know, it keeps happening, and that's the worry. And psychologically, you know, Arsene can make all these comments about mental strength, but the evidence when it really comes down to it is pretty slim about that.
Lindsay, what do you think about this take on it? I mean, it's got to the stage now where Wenger's post-match press conferences have... you know, you can almost script them. He's become a parody of himself. He will talk always about the great quality, the great technique and the great spirit and the great mental strengths in his players. In light of us bottling it when it comes to it, I mean, it seems a rather odd thing to do. Firstly, do you believe his players have this mental strength? And if not, and you know, it does seem unlikely, why does he continue to say it?
Well, I think he's got to say something. You can't, you know. I think it's come from years of them being younger, and kind of protecting them, and maybe giving them the sort of confidence that you know it will come. But clearly, as you've just said, they bottled it. You know, I think it was a cock up on many different levels, tactically, team selection, the players in their own heads. But the bottom line is, they wanted that cup. They could have gone and got it, and they bottled it again on a big occasion. To me, I thought these days we had millions of these sports psychiatrists and psychologists that, you know, with these newfangled things that come in, you know, when all the money came in and stuff, and that was what they were there to do, to get, because there is something missing in their heads. They walked out on that pitch and you just, I think it felt wrong from the minute they walked out. And it was only when Van Persie scored that I actually thought, hold on a minute, we might just do this, we're going to push on, and they look knackered. But who wanted it more? Birmingham wanted it more. And they haven't got the choice of tactics that our managers have. They don't have the choice of personnel that our managers have. They don't have the talent that our manager had. But what they had was heart, desire and a pair of bollocks, and we didn't have any of them.
They also had some war horses, in all fairness. And in their midfield, ran the show against ours. And it was due to...
Ferguson, Bowyer...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Pure commitment.
Which we lack.
Experience. I mean, they've got mental strength. I mean, Bowyer, I mean, we all hate his guts, but he does what he does very well, which is basically wind up the opposition, get away with a hell of a lot. I mean, the guy is... He might be, as an individual, a totally repulsive, but, you know, he proved he is a winner in terms of his attitude. And, you know, a little bit of what he has wouldn't go amiss in some of our players. But, you know, then again, that gets on to the whole different subject area of Arsene not liking a certain type of personality, which is in the embodiment of many an English footballer. Joey Barton being another example. Repulsive individuals, you know. I mean, people you really wouldn't want to meet in your everyday life. And yet, it's that kind of bulldog thing, which in a way maybe we had a bit of when we had some more English players. You know, Keown, Parler. These guys were not as nasty as the likes of Barton and Bowyer, and certainly could behave a lot better than them when off duty. But at the same time, they had something in them which helped Arsenal to win a lot of trophies. And it's interesting to note that since 2005... the English players that we have had at the club have basically been Theo Walcott. Now, in all fairness to Theo, he's not Keown. You know, he's not Ray Parler. He's a nice boy. We're missing
something.
How about
Jack? Jack Wilshere?
Well, he is the hope for the future. And if we had a team full of him, we would have won against Birmingham. But, you know, you can't... One kid can't do it, especially a 19-year-old, you know. There we are.
Yeah, Yes, I'm starting to think whether we bring back Perry Groves Weld and change it for Jack Wilshere.
There have been Frenchmen that have had the same qualities. Look at Patrick Vieira. Yeah, had enough red
surrounded
cards.
By and English, and yeah. Surrounded by English players steeped in the Arsenal culture, who had done things under George Graham. You know, who basically, in fact, when we won the league in '98, it was due to those English guys telling Petit and Vieira to sort themselves out and do their jobs properly that we went on an incredible one run to win the double. So, you know, you need something to rub off on them for them to really become that kind of player.
It's an odd thing, isn't it? You see this you don't care, you don't get in the ground quick enough. You may have seen it at Wembley last week. This god-awful cliched montage with the string music of the day on it, you know, with scenes of great Arsenal scenes past, and a lot of the scenes are, you know, the real leaders covered from head to toe in shit with the clenched fist, clearly mouthing, come on, and it's Adams, and it's Rowcastle, and it's Henri, and it's Vieira. For the life of me, I can't really see Laurent Koscielny doing it. The leapfrogging Frenchman. We haven't actually discussed that yet. The goal that will sell 1,000 blooper DVDs. Oh, I'm Danny Dyer. Welcome to my call, Blimey Bleeding Bugly. Wojciech says he's fallen over. Proper naughty DVD. Which, you know, available in all good high street retailers this Christmas. Before we move on to slightly different passes, Joe, who do you blame for that goal?
50-50 in terms of the players there. I think the keeper should have come out and shouted loudly so that Koscielny could hear him. I don't know what Koscielny was thinking of, quite honestly. He sliced the ball and technically obviously made a mistake. But some pundits said that Szczesny was just as much at fault because he should have taken man and ball and just cleared them both into the stand. Well, it wouldn't be very good, bearing in mind that we've got such a small squad, but that's not Szczesny's problem, is it? I blame both.
Are you a finger pointer, Lindsay?
I don't like doing it, but I think the buck's got to stop with the goalkeeper for me, because I think if you're the man in the goal, you tell everyone else what to do, and if you're loud enough and tell him to get out of the way and you're claiming that ball, then that doesn't happen. Saying that, I don't want to blame either of them. I think it was a freak.
Even if you've got your centre half trying to, you know, get a piggyback off you, Kev?
Well, I mean, basically, Koscielny heard a shout and was in doubt, and so that kind of stopped him whacking it. Now, some centre-backs wouldn't take the chance and just do what was required. You know, they both balled it up in different ways. The nice thing is Szczesny doesn't seem to have been the slightest affected by it. And he is a confident character, and I have no doubt that he will get over it and put it right in future years. Koscielny, he's played well for a couple of months and done well, and yet, you know, he was error prone, and this is another error. And you pointed out to me on Saturday that one of the reasons he makes great saving tackles is because he doesn't sort the ball out in the first instance. Tell him I'm not here. That's only for me. But basically, I think one of the consequences of that final is the jury is still out on Koscielny. And, you know, he's probably not the first choice, even though Wenger would like him to be. I'm just not sure he is going to work out.
He's a second division French centre half. He was last season, and he still is, in my humble opinion. But the one thing we all four of us have agreed on with regard to the Carling Cup final was there's no Theo Walcott, there's no Cesc Fabregas, and obviously after 55 minutes, Van Persie went off as well. It's a question that's been discussed in pubs up and down the Holloway Road throughout N4, 5, and 7. Lindsay, do Arsenal suffer a disproportionate amount of injuries to key players?
It feels like that, doesn't it? Because when we get an injury, it's never a one-match thing. It always seems to be 5, 6, or Vermaelen half a season.
Vermaelen is an Achilles, is 6 to 8 days.
Yes. Or Van Persie and his miracle recovery today. Or Cesc and a hamstring. It seems like it's long. I think why it feels worse to us is because it's always to a key player, the key player that is a game changer.
It's never Danielson. Danielson never breaks both his arms in a freak accident.
And we have tried. It's always a key player, and it's always at a key time. It's always when we're pushing that we lose them. I think also Arsenal suffer from the fact that we have a brilliant first 11, and everybody else is some can come on and do their job, but some can't. And so when you lose one of those key personnel, it feels like we've suffered more because it affects us so much more than maybe potentially Manchester United or Chelsea.
Well, Joe, what do we do about it?
Well, we don't play players when they're injured. I suspect that's what's going on. When you hear that Cesc is 90% fit for the Barcelona game and Robin Van Persie is 70% fit and maybe only 35% fit in his chocolate leg, it's a little bit worrying because long term they're going to keep suffering the same injuries over and over and over again. And I always thought it's about the appliance of science when it comes to Arsene Wenger. That's what he was brought in to do. He was going to change the diets, and he did that successfully. He did a lot of things successfully. Suddenly, as it was alluded to earlier, the sports psychology seems to have gone out of the window. We don't hear anything about it anymore. We used to hear it day in, day out, that psychologically the players were prepared. They go in at half time and they just have silence and think about the mistakes they've made. And now, I don't know, maybe they're still doing the same thing and it doesn't work and they need to reintroduce some new sports psychology or something, because something needs to be done. That's how I'm seeing it at the moment.
Kev, a point that Joe raised there was the one of players playing through injury, which in years gone by would be seen as quite noble and dignified, but in this world of 24-man squads would be seen as foolhardy. A recent example of that we've seen is Alex Song, who seemed to have a very, very poor run of form throughout February, and it since transpired was playing through injury, a knee injury, which has resulted in him not being available tomorrow night against Barcelona. Is this an implicit concession by the manager that the players behind him in that position, being Danielson and Diaby, frankly, aren't good enough?
I think you can only conclude that is the case. And then you go back to the transfer window in the summer and you have to consider what judgments were made upon the playing squad, because the manager would have been fully aware there was every chance of Song being injured, and possibly at that stage he had more faith in Diaby or Danielson. But ultimately, his continuing to select Song tells its own story. And interestingly enough, Song was playing poorly when you know, Wenger was forced to field him, and in the end he had to give up. And look what happened against Sunderland. You know, it was just nothing there. You know, you had the pair of them combined together, and the fluidity and the drive just completely disappeared. I mean, my take on this really is that you take someone like Van Persie and you consider him a very valuable player, but not one you can rely on. So, you know, you decide your first choice striker is going to be a certain individual who, frankly, you might say Nicholas Bentner, I say go and buy somebody. And you use Van Persie when he's fit to help out with the team, but you don't rely on Van Persie because history has shown you can't. And ultimately, you need your best players to play most of the games if you're going to win things. So, you know, Thierry Henry, when he was at the club, missed games through injury, but he didn't miss that many. And he did carry occasional knocks, but the bottom line was he was present and scoring goals a lot more than Robin Van Persie has managed. So I think that basically the club are a bit too generous with players that they know are not reliable, and just try and get by sort of hoping that they're going to be all right. But it's the evidence is so overwhelming that it's not happening, that there has to be a change in philosophy, and there has to be new players brought who do not have an injury record, who are going to give you, you know, 32 out of 38 Premier League games a season. And then when Van Persie's fit, then he's a wonderful addition and a wonderful option, and you can mix and match and rotate. but relying on Robin is inviting disaster.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this particular podcast. The email address for any communications about the podcast is goonapodcast@gmail.com. Thank you once again to our sponsors, goonashirts.com, and just time for Lindsay to give us a quick plug for the indefatigable gunnertalk.com.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to come to gunnertalk.com, you'll find it a world of Arsenal-related stuff. We have loads of videos. We like to tailor it to the game that we're playing on the weekend and give you a matchday experience. So, for example, if we're playing Stoke, we'll have loads of Andy Pulis photoshops, our own made by George compilation that has been removed from YouTube, but will be found at gunnertalk.com. And we also have a section called Gunner Shout, where you will find some interesting and intelligent debate from Arsenal fans. We've got guys such as Marv, who is a Jamaican, who lives in Toronto, Philippe from the Czech Republic, and Boston Guna, who is self-explanatory, and they've all got really interesting things to say and lots of stuff to talk about all through the night because of the varying hours times. Please check us out.
100 different ways to acknowledge Danielson's uselessness.
That is quite frankly.
Thank you, Lindsay. We'll be back with one more offering from this particular recording session very soon. For now, though, my thanks to the panel. I'm your host, David Udoh, saying farewell to you all.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good friends and jolly good company. Well, hey!